Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Mark Eisner, author of a definitive biography of the poet Pablo Neruda. The product of 15 years of research, Neruda, The Poet's Calling, braids together his world-revered poetry, his political engagement, and his tumultuous, even controversial, personal life. Eisner will be in conversation with Baltimore poet and essayist Elizabeth Hazen, Thursday, March 29th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 373. It's Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. Today, our guest is Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian of the American Civil Rights Movement. This conversation comes in advance of King in the Wilderness, an HBO documentary film for which Taylor Branch, who lives here in Baltimore, served as executive producer.
Martin Luther King Jr. was a human being, and he was imperfect. He was conflicted, but his love was unchallengeable.
We have an opportunity to inject morality in the veins of our civilization.
We were trying to redeem the soul of America from racism, war, and poverty.
We're dealing with issues that will call for a restructuring of American society.
The most difficult time of his life was the 18 months before his assassination.
I will continue to preach nonviolence.
I do not know that everything that Martin said or did, he was quite prepared for.
The middle of all that was the rising of the Vietnam War.
Dr. King made the decision that he had to be against the war.
These people are damning me when I say you ought to be nonviolent toward little brown children in Vietnam.
Stick with civil rights!
He said, my friends are turning on me.
He was devastated.
Do you fear for your life?
It isn't so important how long you live. The important thing is how well you live.
Attacks and the criticisms on him were getting more and more vicious.
I'm gonna march if the spirits in march.
The FBI was constantly investigating King.
We will not tolerate lawlessness.
I'm gonna march if the spirits in march.
Dr. King looked me straight in the eye and said, if you can't drive, you run.
If the spirits in march.
You can't run, you walk.
I will march, oh Lord.
You can't walk, you crawl.
I'm gonna march if the spirits in march. If the spirits in march.
But keep moving forward.
The film airs on HBO for the first time on Monday, April 2nd at 8 p.m. Eastern. That is 2 days before the 50th anniversary of the assassination in Memphis of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Be sure to read The Sun's coverage of the anniversary of Dr. King's death and the 1968 riots that ravaged sections of Baltimore in the week following the assassination. Now to Taylor Branch on Dr. King and the civil rights movement before and after his death. Baltimore went into a week of rioting, looting, fires, vandalism, the National Guard after King's death, and some people feel like parts of Baltimore have never recovered from that. And I wonder, as a historian, can we draw a line from 50 years ago and the Baltimore of that moment to the Baltimore today, when we look at the problems that still exist in Baltimore today? Is there a line between those two?
Well, I think there's a line, but I don't think that the aftermath of the King assassination started anything. I think it revealed what was already there, which was that people had really not been aware that there had been this massive migration, both in World War I and World War II, of black people out of the South. Looking for jobs in the North when they could finally travel. And they were herded into by zoning regulations and bank regulations and federal regulations and everything into tightly constricted neighborhoods where, by and large, that's still there. And there was a lot of despair that was loosed when King was killed. But I don't think it created anything as so much as wakening up people up to a festering problem that had been ignored for a long time, and it's still with us.
What about the law and order movement? I mean, I remember Spiro T. Agnew, first as governor of Maryland, then he became the vice president of the United States. Yes, and this push for law and order, which came out of the Nixon administration, followed by the war on drugs, and mass incarceration follows that. If you go decade by decade in the years since that time, is there a line there?
There is a line. Well, to me, there's this great paradox, because on the one hand, there are realities on the liberal side in everyday life that Martin Luther King could scarcely have dreamed of. The rights of senior citizens and disabled people and gays and lesbians that affect black people, white people, everybody else. On the other hand, our public discourse has gotten more cynical since even before King was killed. I trace it to George Wallace, because he was ingenious in inventing, when it was no longer respectable to be for segregation, he invented a language that resented the government for promoting a racial brotherhood. One size fits all, big government, pointy-headed bureaucrats telling you what to do. I mean, he was a genius at all that stuff, and literally claimed that he never used any racial rhetoric. He expunged race from his stump speech and said, I don't do that. And most people wanted to believe him, because nobody wants to think they're a racist or that they've got any problems. And so it really did kind of set the tone for national politics to cover all of that back over. So we're living in this strange era where I think even the white South should be grateful to King's movement for liberating its economy, if nothing else, from segregation, when instead the politics are full of resentment about that period. I mean, a lot of people want to believe that the United States fell into decline from the moment it started recognizing the rights of African Americans. So to me, we have this big, urgent disconnect to try to straighten out between our discourse and the benefits that movement set in motion beyond race, for women. A lot of people don't believe me when I tell them that the year after King died, the college football national championship was won by a team that had 85 players on the roster, not one of them black, on a college football roster at the University of Texas. So even college sports were still segregated.
People want to believe that the civil rights movement had changed all that. And by the time Dr. King died, there was no reason for the cities to explode the way they did. There's no reason for the anger.
No. The change was mostly in the future. The change that put Barack Obama into the White House and that created a black middle class and that created the Sun Belt, for example. Dr. King said, when the black Southern movement wins freedom from segregation, history's wry paradox is that the white South will be liberated. There weren't even any professional sports teams in the South under segregation. And the Atlanta Braves became the first one. They moved from Milwaukee. I'm from Atlanta, and I knew the mayor, and he would chuckle and say, the day the Civil Rights Bill passed, I went to the city council and passed a resolution to build a stadium in Atlanta on land we hadn't bought yet, with money we didn't have, for a team we hadn't located. But within a year, they got the Milwaukee Braves to move to Atlanta. So the real tragedy of race is how strongly people blot out the benefits that they get from racial justice and manufacture or magnify grievances on the privileged side of the line.
What happened to the civil rights movement after Dr. King's death? What would you say, how would you characterize the movement after that? He died, Jesse Jackson remained standing, Stokely Carmichael. Where did it go from there?
Well, they were splintering all over the place. Stokely had already been kicked out of SNCC. he took over from John Lewis in 66. By the end of 67, they kicked him out because he took over saying, we're for only grassroots politics, and King is shooting star media celebrity. And of course, Stokely became a bigger celebrity than King. He was all over the place, and SNCC kicked him out, and he went to Africa, and he tried Marxism, and he kind of flamed out. I love Stokely. He was one of the best interviews I ever had for my civil rights books. But the movement was already splintering because of Black Power and because of the weariness of the nonviolent movement, many, many years of PTSD It's like being in a war. It wasn't going to last forever. And you had the Vietnam War, which really manufactured a mood of hostility. We should have it today because we've been in Afghanistan and in Iraq and for many years. But I think people who lived through the wars in the 1960s in Vietnam could tell you it was a wholly different thing because you had the draft and you had people dying in huge numbers every week. And it was on the TV screen all the time. If the school shootings had been televised on TV so that you saw the obliterated bodies of these school kids on TV, you'd get a sense of what Vietnam was like at the time. It's remarkable in a way now that we don't see that violence in those schools because, I don't know, for some media reason. But Vietnam, it was hard to continue a movement that depended on people taking risks to overcome differences and their fears across racial boundaries when the whole country is trying to gear up to kill people on the other side of the line halfway around the world.
Well, talk about Dr. King in that context, will you? King in the wilderness was part of the problem that there was the Vietnam War, that it was a major distraction from what he was trying to accomplish domestically.
Absolutely. I think it's a real tragedy in a way that the United States did not get a time for truth and reconciliation like South Africa got after apartheid fell. To me, one of the great ironies, the 1st Marine Battalion landed in Da Nang on the shore on March 7, 1965, which is the day of Bloody Sunday in Selma. So the civil rights movement was just peaking with Selma, with nuns, the uplifting, the kumbaya side of the civil rights movement was just peaking when the troops are landing in Vietnam. And by that summer, there are these telephone calls you can hear of Johnson talking to King. And on the one hand, Johnson says, what happened in Selma is the greatest thing. It's the way it ought to be, an energized citizens' movement created popular opinion that allowed me to go before Congress and propose the Voting Rights Act, citizens and responsive leaders. But at the same time, he's talking to King. I hear that you may not be with me in Vietnam. I don't want this war. I don't want it either. But you can see the ground coming out from under him over the war.
King in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I think it means that for the last 3 years of his career, which is what this focuses on, basically after Selma, Dr. King was increasingly pulling his movement into places where even his own movement didn't want to go because he felt that they had an opportunity to make a witness, not to convert the country, but to show that their methods of trying to take risks and have nonviolent demonstrations and reach out to people could be applied to issues beyond just segregation, that it wasn't just and never had been just a Southern issue. That's why he went north to Chicago. He was in exploring Northern sites in April 65, less than a month after the end of Selma. And the staff said, no, we want to stay in the South. We don't know anything about the North. And he said, we have an opportunity to show this country that the race issue has never been just about Southern segregation. And they said, yeah, but we'll lose the Northern media. They loved it when we were in Selma, but they're not going to like it when we're in Boston or Philadelphia Chicago. Or Chicago, which is where he ultimately was. And he said, yes, that's why we have to make the witness. He kept saying over and over again, we have to make the witness because we're trying to be the leaders for this country. And he kept pulling his staff into lonelier and lonelier causes. They didn't want him to take on Vietnam. Most of the NAACP, the Urban League, most of the established black leaders were firmly behind Johnson on the war, arguing that black people historically make progress during wars. They serve as soldiers and so on and so forth. We should start a war, They had one in Vietnam, and people are serving and getting promoted and that sort of thing. And King came out against the war. It was unpopular among his staff, it was unpopular in the country, and of course the press came down on him like a ton of bricks. And not the conservative press, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Nation, magazine, all these magazines attacked him saying, what do you know about war? So, and then he went on to poverty. So the film is about King almost consciously making a witness for the benefits that he thinks continued attention to the principles of his movement, which he called redeeming the soul of America, Nonviolent witness is self-renewing and creating for the promise of democracy and true religious faith. So he felt that the civil rights movement had unlocked this nuclear energy, which finally got rid of segregation in the South, and that it should be applied in other places. But the country was going in a different direction. The Black Power movement was tired. There are some arguments presented in the film between him and Stokely walking along the street, you know, and they went on at night. I wish our film could have shown what went on at night, where Stokely would say, why do we have to be nonviolent? How come America admires nonviolence only in Black people? Why do we have to invite further suffering on us to get white people to stop doing what they shouldn't have been doing in the first place? And King would say, Stokely, it's not fair. I understand your frustration. It's not fair. What I'm trying to get you to see is that nonviolence is a leadership doctrine. The whole point of democracy is to get people to do things by votes rather than by guns. And our movement is a leadership movement. If we say we're tired of this and we're going to become violent, we're not stepping up to our table like John Wayne and James Bond. That's what Stokely would always say. You know, America loves James Bond. They don't love Gandhi. King would say, we're stepping back if we do that. We'll no longer be leaders. And those are very profound debates about the relationship between violence and nonviolence, and we tend to bounce off of them in our discourse, just like we bounce off of race. Most people want to talk about race just long enough to be satisfied that they're not a racist or can't be accused of something and then get off of it. So King was pushing into all those tough areas, and that's why he found himself more and more in the wilderness, because the public enthusiasm and tolerance for his movement had eroded, and there were fewer and fewer people following him on nonviolence. It's interesting. We didn't get to go into it a lot in the film, but the predicate for the Poor People's Campaign was the bonus marchers during the Depression. When the World War I vets came, they were destitute, they were starving, and said, we're putting in for our bonus, which we were promised and never got. And they were run out of town by the army, and it was violent. And King said, yes, but 12 years later, those people were leaders in producing the GI Bill. And if we go up there, it's not going to work, but maybe America will remember one day and do something like the GI Bill, which is one of the greatest, you know, public ventures to create prosperity in a middle class in history. And so he had this plan to create the Poor People's Campaign by taking the poor to Washington, as suggested by Robert Kennedy, believe it or not. And then he got diverted to Memphis. It wasn't part of his planning, but to have sanitation workers strike over the death of their fellows. The trigger for the whole strike was when two sanitation workers were crushed in the back of a garbage truck because Memphis civic rules did not allow them to seek shelter in white neighborhoods in rainstorms. The only place they could go was inside with the garbage. And a broom fell on one of the levers, and they got crushed. And King's mentor in nonviolence, Jim Lawson, who was the guy who had, back in the 50s, trained John Lewis and Diane Nash, and then he was in Memphis, and he was running this movement to support the sanitation workers for economically and to be treated as human beings. King said, I can't turn him down. This really epitomizes what the Poor People's Campaign ought to be about. He saw it as violence. He would always talk about how there's violence of the flesh and there's violence of the spirit. And poverty, in some respects, is caused by violence of the spirit. He's not saying that money is free and that money grows on trees, but he's saying that poverty persists because there's more violence of the spirit in the society than we realize. And that's what he was trying to campaign against.
Some of the news footage of his speeches in his last year are almost prophetic in terms of his death. It's like he knows it's coming.
I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, we are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked And to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now.
Harry Belafonte, substituting as a host on The Tonight Show, asks him if he feared for his life, and King gives one of his great responses. You know, it's not how long you live, it's how you live your life. But still, he looks like such a worried man in that footage from 67 and 68. I'm sure there were death threats all along, all through his career. But what about that in the last few months? He seemed to be carrying a great weight, more so than in the past.
I think one of the weights that he was carrying, Dan, and it's hard for us to remember this now because we look back on him as a national holiday, he's very famous. We assume that he was high and commanding at the end. He was, one of the weights he was carrying was that there wasn't a lot of public attention to what he was doing the way there had been in Selma. I interviewed a lot of people when I was doing my book who said that they were just hit in the chest when they heard the news from Memphis, but their next reaction was, oh my God, I lost track with him. What's he been doing lately? It's not like he was front and center the way he had been in 63, 64 in Birmingham and Mississippi and the march and stuff like that. I mean, he even had staff people maneuvering to take over for him and push him out of the way. So he had, he was dealing with obscurity and the fact that there wasn't a lot of public attention. That's why he kept saying, we are making a witness here, that even if we don't capture America's attention the way we did in Birmingham or in Selma, we want to leave a witness here that America can wake up to, that we helped it address its most intractable problems in segregation. It was inarguably good for everybody. And it can happen again if we summon the public will and the public courage to discuss it and do it. And this is how we do it. And so he did his anti-war stuff and his anti-poverty stuff in the North and then the Poor People's Campaign, and he left behind this witness. And I'm hoping, but he was in the wilderness in this sense.
He was in the wilderness, meaning he was confused about what to do? I mean, he did all these things, but there was no one thing anymore. Earlier, there had been one goal, it seemed like.
I call it kind of an upward king and a downward king. The earlier part of his career, from the bus boycott up through the Nobel Prize, King is in some senses like a politician. He's trying to get to the White House. He's trying to promote his cause. He's acting like a politician. When he got to the Nobel Peace Prize and he ended segregation, 10 years of struggle, believe me, everybody on his staff said, we can go to chicken dinners on this Nobel Peace Prize and ending segregation for the rest of our lives. And he said in Oslo, no, we have to go back.
I still believe that we shall overcome. This faith can give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds, and our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, we will know that we are living in the creative turmoil of a genuine civilization struggling to be born.
He was in jail within a month of the next month of getting the Nobel Prize, and he took him to Selma. Nobody wanted to go to Selma. And then as soon as Selma crescendos and takes over the country, and everybody's heard something about Selma, he's saying, we need to go north. And they didn't want to go north. And he became more and more possessed or driven. I don't think he changed his mind about anything. I think he wanted to risk more of himself for the logical consequences of what the nonviolent movement could address, how close it was to the democratic spirit. He warned America that if we didn't deal with the inner dynamics of what that movement meant, that we could lose the democratic discourse. How to talk about it? How do you measure a democracy? And I think the lesson of his life is that when we're dealing honestly with race, we make progress on democracy. And when we're obfuscating it or turning away from it, we kind of lose our way. We don't even have talks about the principles of democracy anymore, which is why we're in an openly cynical era. Everybody says we're in a cynical era, but nobody asks why. And I think in some respects, the answer to that is because we'll have to talk about race if we do.
Do you ever look back at that sometimes and think of 1968? You know, a month later, Robert Kennedy was killed. When we talk about a loss of hope, it's a wonder people who were involved in the movement, who believed things were going to change, that things were going to get better, took part in anything after that. Wouldn't have been completely despondent.
A lot of people got angry. That's when you got the radical, like the weathermen, running down Pennsylvania Avenue, breaking windows in the Justice Department, oblivious to the fact that that was turning masses of voters against them rather than for them. Extremes in times where there's not a lot of public optimism, extremes gain an advantage, and they really do muddy the waters, and it's really hard for people to raise principled arguments that are hopeful and change the public mood. Cynicism is really hard to combat, I think, because it's an appetite, and it takes over. It's remarkable that King stayed optimistic throughout his whole career. He gave hopeful speeches, you know, his last speech where he's talking about the fact that he may not get there with you. He's saying, we will get to the promised land.
Now, it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Even after he died, the last article that came out of his said, you know, the problem is that America is infected with racism, but the hope is that America is also infected with democratic ideals. And, you know, we'll get to freedom because America's about freedom as long as we keep that in the forefront. So I think that's what makes King's rhetoric so striking, even beyond the words, is he was no Pollyanna. He knew how tough things were, I mean, and how tough things could be, how tough history was. And yet he's hopeful, and you hear that wrestling. His voice is like a furnace, so you know it's creating heat, and he's maintaining a hope against that acknowledgement of how tough race has been in American history since before the Revolution.
How old was he when he died? He was only
39.
He was only 39, so he might have been alive today, right?
Yes,
John Lewis is.
He'd be 88.
What do you think he'd be making of this presidency that we have now? Of this climate in the country? This culture.
I think the climate in the country would be really bad, that people are not appreciating where hope is and not really dealing. They're cultivating their resentments rather than trying to figure out how to move the country forward. On the other hand, he would have said, look what happened. Nobody thought the Soviet Union was going to dissolve without a shot being fired and them singing We Shall Overcome at the Berlin Wall. Nobody thought apartheid was going to come apart without an Armageddon. And it did. So we consistently overlook the miracles that are offering hope and hang on to things that preserve the gridlock that we have, because the gridlock is a sign of lost hope.
When we come back to Baltimore for a moment, you live in Baltimore.
I do.
When we had the day of rioting, vandalism and fires on April 25th, 2015, the day they buried Freddie Gray. And prior to that, we had Black Lives Matter. We had a movement against excessive force by police, the deaths of unarmed black men at the hands of police. Did you see parallels then between what King was doing? Do you think King would have been at the forefront of that?
I think King would have been at the forefront of any time, any place where people feel that they have no resort but to violence. I mean, that's one of the main reasons that he spoke against the Vietnam War. He said, and you see it in the film, he said, I can't go into the ghettos of America and preach against violence when they're asking me, if violence is so bad, how come they're sending us halfway around the world to kill brown people in Vietnam? He said, I've got to be able to deal with violence wherever it occurs, including in my own government. What's gone on in the cities is a manifestation of loss of hope, and it didn't happen by accident. We consistently misremember how vital race is to whether we are or are not making progress on you know, democratic potential and democratic principles. The amazing thing to me about King's civil rights movement is that it said the only thing we have going for us is that we will study the essence of democratic principles and the power that are in there and find a way to force people to confront that. They were a tiny minority. They didn't have any traditional weapons. They were largely invisible. So how are they going to change the power relations of a great nation? There wasn't a single elected representative between Texas and the Atlantic Ocean who was in favor of getting rid of the segregation law. So it was a miracle that they hoped to do that. And to me, it's quite telling that right from the beginning, King said, we're going to not just end segregation, we're going to redeem the soul of America. We're going to dig deep in the wells of democracy to help America become what she should be. It's tremendously, fantastically ambitious that this minority that was mostly maids and sharecroppers on plantations in the South is saying, we're going to fix America, not just the problems applying to us. To me, it's just, that's why I've been so wonderstruck by studying the movement most of my life. I think we're so lucky to have it.
I was just going to ask you, do you ever get tired of talking about this? But it doesn't sound like it.
No.
This is your life's work. But as you just described that, mm-hmm. When you just laid that out, I can see why you still remain excited about it.
I am. And I think there's hope still there. And I think that when people are eager to talk about race and how race has advanced democracy and how we've betrayed democracy when we've shied away from it, it ought to make it more important that how serious it is to be a citizen in a government of we the people, and that what a great lesson it is that you had Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and Fannie Lou Hamer and all of these people who took those lessons so seriously that they unlocked that power. And it's been locked up again, to me, to our peril. I'm hoping that period of denial, cynicism about government has run its course after 50 years. You know, 50 years after the end of the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln stood at his second inaugural address, said, you know, everybody knew that somehow slavery was the, and it's an offense that may last until every lash drawn by the bondsman is repaid by another drawn with a sword. 50 years later, in World War I, there were no black soldiers there. Woodrow Wilson said it was impertinent to even think about what Gettysburg or the Civil War meant. And we'd forgotten all of that, everything that Lincoln struggled, the wisdom that Lincoln struggled for. And I think 50 years after King's, some of the things you hear King say in this film that are profound but sadly prophetic because they're ignored, I'm hoping that people will realize that we've been kind of forgetting the potential and the lessons of the civil rights movement for 50 years, and until they're buried in cynicism. And to my view, Trump is logical in a weird way. He's logical, a logical end to that sense of denial and hostility to the promise of democratic government. And another movement needs to lift us out of that, you know. And we may not be lucky enough to have it be a black-led movement again. We need everybody to pitch in. But I know you didn't ask me to come here to give a little speech, but I do think this film will be instructive to a lot of people who don't know anything about Martin Luther King except I have a dream and think that he was an extremely popular figure and that that was good but not pertinent to today because it was just about where people sat on the bus and that he handled that problem, but it's irrelevant to today. Because I think when you see King's movement here, it's about the future because it was a movement that was really saying even the least of these can be leaders in the promise of a government of we the people. And our job is to raise hope and to be disciplined and to confront our most difficult problems. And that kind of movement is sorely needed. I think King's about the future, not about the past. And even despite all the pain you see going through, he was in the wilderness because the country was already abandoning him.
Yet he remained an optimist.
Yet he remained an optimist, which is an amazing lesson.
Taylor, thank you.
Thank you.
Taylor Branch did Herculean work in writing the history of the Civil Rights Movement, a trilogy of books about America in the King years. His first book in that series, Parting the Waters, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1989. King in the Wilderness, an HBO documentary film for which Taylor Branch served as executive producer, airs on HBO for the first time on Monday, April 2nd at 8 p.m. Eastern. Be sure to read The Sun's coverage of the 50th anniversary of King's death and the riots that ravaged sections of Baltimore in the week following his assassination. You can find links to the stories in the notes with this podcast. That's our show for now. Roughly Speaking, we'll be on hiatus for about 2 weeks. We'll pick up again with new episodes in the second week of April. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get the chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thank you for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Mark Eisner, author of a definitive biography of the poet Pablo Neruda. The product of 15 years of research, Neruda, the Poet's Calling, braids together his world-revered poetry, his political engagement, and his tumultuous, even controversial, personal life. Eisner will be in conversation with Baltimore poet and essayist Elizabeth Hazen, Thursday, March 29th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.